you know it, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin. And let's see how the ball's going about today.
Basketball historian Tim Gallagher joins the Bullseye again. Tim, great to talk to you again, and looking forward to hearing the continuation of the discussion we had before on your basketball book. So why don't we hit the ground running and give the audience some suggestions over the to read over the next month or two before we start. Thank goodness, basketball's not that far away.
Right. It is a little bit of a quiet time, so I thought that would be a good stage to talk about some great basketball books that I've enjoyed over the years and recently. And just a little bit of a backdrop on it, more than books that are kind of description and accounts of games. I really like the books that are, you know, delving into the journey, the personalities, the games within the game, the influences, what drives someone as an athlete, and also even deeper than that, kind of the generation before them. So maybe this player or coach's parents or the people and city that he came from that shaped them. Those kind of things are what I really look for in a story and in a book. So that kind of has a little influence on the kind of books that I'm going to be recommending here. And one other little side note, I've been gobbling up basketball books since I was in grade school, getting my hands on everything I can read about the game and players and coaches. And so there's a book I'm reading at the moment that was referred to me by a friend back in New York City, and it's called Historic Hoosier Gems. And so that's the book that's on my nightstand at bed at night. And I've been reading through that, and it's pretty fascinating because it profiles 100 Indiana high school gyms that still exist, but they're no longer used for high school games. So a lot of them have been repurposed for rec centers or warehouses or residences or, you know, all kinds of things. But, you know, just a fascinating look at the towns where these gyms were, and oftentimes in Indiana, especially with the craziness of high school basketball, the gyms were much bigger than the population of the cities, right? Which is, you know, incredible to think of. But
wow.
A couple reasons for that. So one was just the pride in basketball in that community, which certainly still exists, and just the love of basketball in Indiana. But also their goal was to try to have a gym that was big enough to host sectional tournaments. So obviously everyone's seen Hoosiers and knows that story, and we'll talk about that when we do a podcast on basketball movies. But just a fascinating look at these facilities, and it's very consumable because it's one page. There's a photo of the gym, kind of an outside and inside look at it as it is today. And then the other page is just a capsule of that high school, that city, and a little history of that. And so my wife said, gosh, how many books can there be on basketball? You're always reading something on basketball. And I said, well, when I read a book like this, for me it's history, geography, sociology, architecture. So I'm trying to sound more sophisticated than my wife thinks I am with just strictly reading about a ball and a hoop. So some of these books really delve into things like that, which is fascinating. And obviously basketball is the backdrop for it. But, you know, a book like that is kind of right up my alley because you just hear the histories of these communities. And now a lot of these small Indiana towns have, the schools have consolidated, and you know, as our world and population and, you know, and how people earn a living has changed over the years, you know, a lot of these small towns don't really exist anymore, but, you know, many of them had their day in the sun when it related to high school basketball in Indiana. And in a place like that, those people never forget those teams and those players.
What a labor to document and identify those gyms in Indiana. And I mean, is this a modern book? Has this come out recently? It's amazing that you found it.
Yeah, no, it's very recent. It just came out. The author is a guy named Kyle, and I may not be pronouncing his last name right. It's Neddenreip. So I guess Neddenreip or Neddenreip. So, yeah, it's a new book. And so obviously it was a labor of love for him, and you know, it's kind of gotten me thinking, too, of a road trip someday to try to visit some of those gyms and maybe sneak in there and get some shots up in some of them. And anyway, that's a book I'm reading now, and
cool.
A funny little side story of my life, my wife, and basketball, I guess you'd say. But from there, I thought we'd go into some other books that I want to recommend, and they're not in any exact order, but so we'll just kind of move through the list here, and certainly stop me if you have questions or want to pursue any of them. But the next, and this one's a package of two books because they're really about the same player, and they're by the same author. So the author is a guy named Bill Reynolds, who's an incredible basketball writer based out of Providence, Rhode Island. And he himself was a former player at Brown University and has written about how basketball was kind of his ticket to get to a school like Brown. And obviously he had the academics as well, but it kind of paved the way for him and his life. And he's written a number of excellent basketball books. But the two I'm going to talk about now are about a player named Chris Herron. So he was a former NBA player, also played in college, originally at Boston College very briefly, and then at Fresno State. But people may know of him also. There's an ESPN 30 for 30 called Unguarded because he became a drug addict. And despite his talent as a player, his life really derailed. And the positive ending of the story is now he's a speaker and travels all around the country speaking with young people and college teams, pro teams, about the risks and evils of substance abuse. But the first book that was written about Chris Herron is when he was in high school, and it's called Fall River Dreams. So kind of like I talked about at the beginning, it really is a portrayal of the city of Fall River, Massachusetts, kind of an industrial, tough place to live and grow up, and how basketball was a key shining light in that city. And Chris, in particular, as a high school All-American level player, was a local hero. And so the book is about his journey as a high school player and in the city and the team. And then years later, and I mentioned some of the demons that Chris Herron then had to battle, and it's an incredible story, but Bill Reynolds wrote a follow-up book called Basketball Junkie, which was about Chris Heron's life kind of post Fall River and Fall River Dreams. And so excellent books. Also, that ESPN 30 for 30 kind of ties it all together as well, if somebody wants to try to consume it in that fashion. So anyway, that's the one we'll start out with. And Bill Reynolds has written other books about the Big East and Rick Pitino and a number of other basketball-related subjects. So just a wonderful writer, the way he's able to spin the stories. Next one I wanted to talk about was Back from the Dead, the new book that's out by Bill Walton. And so any of you that follow Bill Walton or listen to him knows he can go on and on endlessly about a lot of things. But this book really focuses on a couple things that are near and dear to me, which are San Diego, where I've lived now for almost 30 years, basketball, of course, and then rock and roll. So Bill Walton's obviously a self-professed deadhead, but also a huge fan of all music, but Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, the Beach Boys, it's all over the map. But so this is the latest book from Bill and his life and his journey, and he's always very unfiltered with what he talks about. So it makes for pretty fascinating reading in terms of Bill's journey. And if you like those topics, it's an excellent read, and again, just recently published.
Really quick, Tim, I'd like to jump in there with a question on Walton. Where do you rank him on your all-time list? I mean, you always hear so much about him that, that was a great player just derailed by injuries and a career derailed by injuries. Do you feel he would have been one of the best of all time if he didn't suffer those, I think they were foot injuries, correct me if I'm wrong.
Right, right. And he was plagued by foot problems, and that's a big part of his story, actually, and is some of the physical issues that he had. And part of it was some congenital things that he was born with just bad feet, let's say. but then he didn't really know better as well. He talks a lot about it, where he just thought that everybody that played basketball, their feet were sore and it didn't feel good, but they just kept playing anyway. So he didn't really realize, how unique some of this was to him and his body. And then, the other aspect, too, is some of the medical advances we have today compared to in the early 70s when he was playing at UCLA and then making his way to the NBA, you know, things would probably be a lot different now in terms of medical treatment and how his issues would have been dealt with. But all that said, you know, his career certainly got derailed by injuries, but he is in the Hall of Fame. And if you look at his career when he was healthy, he was part of three of the greatest teams of all time. Obviously, those UCLA teams that he was part of, you know, two of his three varsity seasons, they won NCAA titles and essentially were unbeaten. And then his senior year, which was a bit of a disappointment, they lost a few games and made it to the Final Four, but lost in the semifinals to David Thompson and NC State. And then when he finally got healthy with the Blazers, there was that legendary 1977 team that won the NBA title, and he was, you know, led that charge, and they beat the Sixers with Dr. J and George McGinnis and Daryl Dawkins. And then the next season were on a Golden State Warriors-like start in terms of one of the best starts in history. And then, again, his injuries flared up again, and that really derailed him for years, you could say. And then when he finally got healthy enough to play late in his career, he was a key part of the Celtics championship teams with Bird, McHale, Parrish, Dennis Johnson, Danny Ainge, that whole group, even though he was now, instead of the centerpiece, he was more of a role player off the bench, but healthy enough and was a key player in that championship season. So it is a bit of an interesting discussion because of what could have been, yet when he was healthy and playing, that UCLA, Portland, and Boston team, are, you know, those are talked about as some of the greatest teams in the history of the game. And he happened, it wasn't a coincidence that he was part of those.
Great. Great. Sorry to interrupt. Let's go on to the next book.
Sure. Well, I guess while we're on UCLA and Walton, it's kind of a nice segue to talk about Coach Wooden. And John Wooden is someone that's very near and dear to me, and have read almost everything written about him and by him. And, you know, his Pyramid of Success and all of the Woodenisms are key themes in my life to this day. But so there's a lot to read on the topic of John Wooden. But I'd say there's two books that I would say stand out. The one that John Wooden wrote, and he co-authored some books with a number of authors, but the one that I'd recommend is called Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations on and Off the Court, and it's by Wooden and Steve Jamison. So that one is kind of a good, the Woodenisms, Philosophy of Life, Pyramid of Success, all that. That's an excellent book for those of you that want to pick one for Coach Wooden. And then the other side of it is a book about John Wooden. So he's written so many, but I enjoyed reading the perspective of someone writing about him. And the book I liked the best in that category is called Wooden, An American Treasure by Steve Bishoff. That's B-I-S-H-E-F-F. So he does a really nice job of just kind of taking you through Coach Wooden's life and successes. And Coach Wooden was so humble that a lot of times the books he was writing, he maybe would leave things out, or, you know, just maybe not think it would be of interest to fans for various reasons. And so Steve Bishoff kind of gives a more of a, I guess, an unfiltered look at Coach Wooden's life. And unfiltered, I don't mean there was really any dark side to Coach Wooden's life or anything, but just some details and perspective on his life, I think, that are really interesting. So lots to read about Coach Wooden. The next one I'll mention will hit home for Bulls fans. I know there's a couple great books about the Bulls in the Jordan era. Of course, The Jordan Rules by Sam Smith. I think probably most listeners know who Sam is and what he's written. Another one that I really like, though, on that same era, and an in-depth look at Jordan and kind of what makes him tick, is by the legendary writer David Halberstam, and it's called Playing for Keeps. So, great book about Jordan, his life, and of course, if you're a Bulls fan, it's, you know, right in your sweet spot there. And, you know, and there's another book that David Halberstam, well, he's written many, many books. He unfortunately passed away several years back in an accident, but written a lot of great books about a number of things, politics, you know, social issues, that kind of thing. But another book he wrote is called The Breaks of the Game, which is essentially a journal of a season with the Portland Trailblazers in 1979. So kind of a real in-depth look of traveling with a team. And again, in 79, that's you know, just before Bird and Magic, before Jordan got to the NBA. So kind of a little different league in those days. And of course, Bill Walton was still a key thread in that story because he was just leaving Portland to go to the then San Diego Clippers around that time. So that's another excellent book by Halberstam.
What year did Portland win the title? Was it 77?
77.
And yeah. So that would be, is that Dr. Jack coaching that team, or am I wrong in that?
It is, yeah, Dr. Jack Ramsey, yep, with his plaid sport jackets and, a legendary,
sure.
Legendary coach and executive in the game, sure.
Okay, so that covers that team. That sounds interesting. Was it a team that had high expectations that faltered? Just give a little 411 on that 79 Blazers team.
I'm not exactly sure why that particular team, they were a playoff team, and you know, Portland had success, you know, kind of in the post-Walton era as well, and picked up players like Michael Thompson and Jim Paxson, and Maurice Lucas was still there as a key player that was on the 77 title team. So I think it just so happened that the dynamics of that situation and Walton, and that was the one that Halberstam chose. I haven't read that book for quite a few years, so I don't remember what maybe prompted him for that team in that season, but an excellent read either way.
Great.
I'll group these next two books together as well because it kind of ties in the same theme, and it's about playground basketball or New York City basketball. And actually, some Chicago area listeners may know the name Rick Tellender, who's a former Northwestern football player and well-known sports writer for many years with Sports Illustrated and other publications. But in the summer of 1974, he went to New York City to do a story, he thought, but it ended up being he spent the whole summer there playing playground basketball, pickup basketball, and ended up writing this book called Heaven is a Playground, which is just a wonderful read, still in print, still getting acclaim. And a couple of the key players that he followed that summer in New York City were a guy named James Fly Williams, who was a playground legend, still alive in the New York City area. He ended up going to Austin Peay State University of all places, but was one of the nation's leading scorers and a real dynamic player, and also a very interesting cheer that they had when he was there. So again, his nickname was Fly Williams. So the chant they would have is, "The fly is open, let's go pee." So kind of a classic college cheer there from Fly Williams' days at Austin Peay State University in Clarksville. But Fly was a very colorful and interesting character. He actually played a year in the ABA with the Spirits of St. Louis, which we could do a whole other podcast just on that team and that situation. But Fly Williams was one of the key characters in the book, as well as Albert King, who's the younger brother of Bernard King. And Albert played at Maryland and had a long NBA career, but he was kind of the top prospect, the top emerging young player in New York City at the time that was playing in the playgrounds then. And so a real fascinating slice of life.
First book I've read that you've mentioned that I've actually read, I really enjoyed it back in the day. I was probably in high school, late 80s or early 90s when I read it. Really enjoyed it. Rick Tellender is a favorite. I believe he still writes for Chicago Sun-Times, but he was on a show called Sports Writers on TV in the mid-80s, which I really liked a lot with Bill Jouse and a couple old-time sports writers. I don't know if you remember that. If you got that out in Phoenix at the time, probably is where you were at, right?
Yeah. Well, I remember it, and maybe some of that made its way to ESPN at some point, sports writers type show. But I definitely remember seeing Rick on a format like that. And he's one of those guys I can't get enough of. When he wants to write or talk about sports, I'm all for it. I just love his style. And then there's another book that's similar to that that was written around the same time called The City Game by Pete Axthelm. People might remember Pete Axthelm as a broadcaster as well, and I think he used to do some things with the NFL and maybe odds, kind of like a Jimmy the Greek type guy with predictions of games and things, if my memory serves me correctly. But he was also a New York City-based writer And that book's also about New York City playground legends, but then also kind of ties in the Knicks of the early 70s. Of course, they won championships in 70 and 73 with Willis Reed, Walt Frazier, Dave DeBuscher, Bill Bradley, you know, Dick Barnett, Earl Pearl, that group. So that's a nice book that kind of covers the New York City basketball scene, both from a playground level to the Garden and the Knicks. So I wanted to touch on those as well.
Really cool.
Another book that's a little bit off the radar and amazingly is out of print, but I think you could still find it somewhere on Amazon, but it's called Where'd You Get Those? Which is by a writer named Bobito Garcia. And actually, Bobito is also well-known in a number of areas of music and hip-hop and as a writer of both music and entertainment and pop culture, but basketball is kind of his passion. And so this book is called Where'd You Get Those? It's really a history of the New York City basketball and sneaker culture. So it's kind of a blend of fashion, hip-hop, the evolution of basketball shoes, and it's written and presented in just an incredible way. And when I'm talking about the evolution of basketball shoes, obviously we kind of know the world today with, you know, with Jordans and LeBrons, and you know, the shoes are named for the players, right, rather than what brand they are. But it kind of takes basketball shoes from the early days of the canvas Chuck Taylors or even before that, and kind of the emergence of to something a little different. So, you know, when Adidas and Pro Kids and Reebok kind of started making their way into the scene with something other than just canvas white Chuck Taylors, there were, you know, Adidas that were leather with stripes, Pro Kids that were suede, and then of course the emergence of Nike, and you know, and then most people could kind of pick it up from there in terms of where things have gone in the way of basketball shoes. But it's just an incredible book, the way it's presented, and kind of the you know, kind of in a pre you know, ordering things online and you know, having so many products at your fingertips, where you could go to find some sneakers that were maybe a little different or a little offbeat or something that you know, would make you stand out. You know, beyond having your game do the talking, you obviously wanted to be styling on the court as well with what kind of shoes you were wearing. So it really talks about the beginnings of that. And of course now players have shoe contracts, you know, that are, you know, ridiculously higher than any player, you know, playing contracts were back in the day, right? So it's really a fantastic book. And again, Bobito Garcia, you know, he's also the subject of a real interesting documentary. It's called Stretch and Bobito, Radio That Changed Lives, which is a kind of an evolution of hip-hop music. And Bobito was also a DJ, and helped hip-hop music essentially go mainstream. And a lot of artists in their early days in New York and beyond, he was kind of a central point to help get that music out there. So
really,
I really highly recommend it. You know, the other little thing I thought about reading that book, it was interesting that, you know, now if somebody showed up at the playground with, you know, a brand new pair of shoes, you'd think nothing of it, right? But in the old days, if somebody would show up at the playground wearing brand new sneakers, you would automatically think, well, this guy hasn't been playing. You know, he must not be a player. You know, you wanted to have your shoes be somewhat worn to show that you've been playing. And just how the whole shift now, where you show up now in a pair of scuffed up or well-worn sneakers, it's the other way. You'd think, boy, this guy must not be a player because his shoes are all, you know, worn. He doesn't have the right kicks on, right? So just, I mean, there's little anecdotes like that all throughout the book, and his adventures through New York to try to find these offbeat shoe stores that where he could find a pair of Adidas or Pro Kids or something that was, you know, that was a little more fashionable and hip to wear other than the Chucks.
Really cool. Great suggestions. You got a few more for us?
Yeah, a couple more. Yeah, well, the next one, there's two different books about the same topic as well, two different books, two different authors, and this one's about Pistol Pete Maravich, which we've obviously talked about him a number of times on the podcast, kind of a revisit, I guess you'd say, of Pistol Pete with the way Steph Curry has been playing over the last couple of seasons. That kind of sparked a lot of interest in Pistol Pete and what Pistol was doing many, many decades ago before Steph ever came along. But there's two books that are wonderful about Pistol Pete, and one of them is called Pistol, The Life and Times of Pete Maravich by Mark Kriegel. And actually, the Adrian Wojnarowski podcasts, there's an interview fairly recently with Mark Kriegel where, among other things, he talks about his research and writing of that book. So really urge you to check that out as well as reading the book. And the second is another book that came out about the same time, just called Maravich, and it's by Wayne Fetterman. So again, they both are kind of the life and times of Pistol Pete. And as I mentioned at the front end of the podcast, Maravich's life story is pretty fascinating with his family heritage. His father, Press Maravich, was a well-known player kind of in the pre-NBA industrial leagues and then became Pete's coach. And at LSU, where Maravich set scoring records that stand to this day and will never be broken. Really fascinating books about Pete. And in the Wayne Fetterman book, I'm actually listed in the credits. I think I've mentioned in the podcast I've got quite a collection of basketball memorabilia and autographs. And when Pete became a born-again Christian after his playing days, oftentimes he would sign his autographs with different Bible verse references. So I ended up finding Wayne Fetterman through the Internet and seeing some video highlight films he put together on Maravich, and we started corresponding, and he found out about my collection and items. So I ended up sending him copies of some of the different signatures I'd gotten from Maravich where he'd written different Bible verses. So he used that as part of his research for the book.
Awesome. Fantastic. Go ahead. Next suggestion?
Yep. We'll go with two more, and then we'll wrap up. I know we've been touching on a lot of excellent reads, and people are probably compiling their lists here for the future. But the next are two different books about Jerry West. One West wrote about himself, and these are both fairly recent books. So West by West, it's called My Charmed and Tormented Life. So that's the one Jerry wrote himself. And then there's another book about him called Jerry West, The Life and Legend of a Basketball Icon. It's by an author named Roland Lazenby. And we've talked often about Jerry West on podcasts over the last year and a half or so that we've been talking. And you can make an argument that he's the most significant figure in the history of basketball, everything from being the logo of the NBA to his exploits as a college player, an Olympian, an NBA star, an NBA executive. So he's quite an interesting person. And again, his journey from the hills of West Virginia and pretty humble upbringing to the fame that he's achieved is a very fascinating life story. And the author that wrote the book about him, Roland Lazenby, happens to be a West Virginia native also. So there's some significant things about Jerry West and being from West Virginia. In fact, Lazenby said when he first started researching the book, Pete Newell, who was Jerry West, 1960 USA Olympic team coach, and then was an executive with the Lakers when West was part of that organization, said, to understand Jerry West, first you have to understand West Virginia. So again, kind of like as I touched on in the front end of the podcast, that you kind of look at the town that he's from, the people that were influential to him, his family, his coaches, you know, all of that kind of, you know, leads you to his life story, which is really good stuff.
Lazenby, I believe, also wrote, from what I've heard, a fantastic Jordan biography that just came out not long ago, within the last year or so. And I would highly recommend that from what I've heard. I haven't read it yet. I do have it on my get-to list, though.
Yes, I haven't read that one either, but from reading other things from Lazenby, and he was a writer that covered the Lakers for many years as well. He's, again, kind of like a Bill Reynolds and Rick Callender. He's just anything he writes is good, but when it's about basketball and some of the things that I'm passionate about, even better. So I guess the last one we'll touch on, just for the sake of time, is Sacred Hoops by Phil Jackson. So I know Phil's written many books about different stages of his basketball career and basketball life, but I thought Sacred Hoops was the one that really was the most enjoyable for me, and where he talks about his upbringing and in the Dakotas and playing for the Knicks and then coaching early in his career in minor leagues like the CBA. So before he became this iconic Zen master, you know, he led quite a basketball journey. And the other thing that was interesting in that book, a couple of players that were kind of key figures in my basketball life and development in Dayton, Ohio, are noted in that book. So Don May, who was my boyhood hero that played for the University of Dayton, was Phil's teammate on the 1970 Knicks. And then when Phil was coaching Albany in the CBA, there was a player named Frankie J. Sanders, who was from Dayton Stuyvesant-Patterson High School and played at Southern University and then made his way to the NBA, but also played in the CBA for Phil Jackson. And Frankie was one of those classic, talented but troubled guys. And so even somebody like the Zen Master Phil was sometimes confounded by what Frankie was up to and trying to keep him on course and help him win games. So, again, many books by Phil, but Sacred Hoops is a real treat.
Really cool. Do you got a few minutes to go over the Hall of Fame, or do you want to hit that in our next show?
No, I've got a few minutes. Yeah, we can do little thumbnail capsules of some of the key inductees here coming into Springfield. So, yeah, I'll just kind of knock through them real quick, and if there's any other thoughts or questions, let me know. But and for some of them, I've had some personal encounters and experiences, which I can touch on. So the first one we'll start with is Shaq, Shaquille O'Neal. So I always thought it was fascinating, the story about how Dale Brown, the LSU coach, discovered Shaq. And, you know, that story is kind of legendary, but it's true. In fact, at a Final Four a couple of years ago, I kind of verified everything with Dale Brown because I was with my younger son, and Dale Brown was holding court in the coach's hotel lobby in Indianapolis. And so he's kind of happy to share any stories with interested fans. So, you know, the story was Dale Brown was conducting a clinic at a military base in West Germany in 1985, and Shaq's father was in the military. I think most people have probably heard that over the years. And so after the clinic, Shaq approached Coach Brown and asked him if he could help him with some of his footwork or help him, you know, learn how to dunk the ball better. Well, at the time, Shaq was 6'8", so Dale Brown asked, well, you know, soldier, when are you going to be out of the service? And he said, well, sir, I'm only 13 years old. And so,
God.
And so Dale Brown said, you know, take me to meet your father immediately. And so the legend has it that Shaq's dad was actually in a sauna at the time. And so Shaq and Dale Brown walk into the sauna, you know, fully clothed, and Dale Brown is meeting Shaq's dad. And, well, I guess Dale Brown stuck with his focus and commitment because, you know, what, 3-4 years later, he got Shaq at LSU. So
I surprisingly have never heard this story. I'm shocked to hear it. So Shaq was living overseas? I wasn't even aware of that. I knew that's his stepfather, right, who was in the military,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I believe it was Philip Harrison. I don't know the rank that he was. But yes, that's I've read and confirmed that story. In fact, knowing that we were going to talk about Shaq and that, I Googled it just to make sure I was accurate on my memory of how the story went. But can you just imagine Dale Brown, you know, looking up to this 6'8" young man, finding out he was only 13, and without missing a beat saying, son, take me to meet your father immediately. And
that's great.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing with Shaq, I got a chance to see him play in college in person at LSU. They played Tennessee with Allen Houston. That was the opponent that day. And one of my college roommates was in the graduate program at LSU at the time, and Shaq was there. And, of course, being a basketball fan, I worked out a trip to go see him and see the game. And so that was a very memorable experience. In fact, got my picture taken with Shaq at the time. And when you see Shaq in this photo, you'll see how thin he is compared to what he became. Obviously, he was huge and a big guy, but still a lot thinner than he became in his playing days. And obviously now, you know, is a mountain of a man now. But the thing about Shaq that was so interesting, aside from just his playing abilities and championships that he won, was his personality, right? So you think of the big guys before him, like Wilt and Russell and Kareem, you know, they weren't very approachable or just the persona was not one that was easy for fans to love. I mean, they loved them as players and winners and, you know, and the accomplishments they had on the court. But with Shaq, just his charm and humor and personality for anyone, but then for someone his size was pretty unique. And I think that makes him, you know, one of the more cherished players in the history of the game. And he obviously still loves it and part of the TNT broadcasts. And it just doesn't seem to take himself too seriously. And just always been a fan of Shaq since seeing him in those early days at LSU. And I'll put that picture on my Facebook account so the listeners can go there and check it out, the, you know, Tim Gallagher Facebook page. And I think you'll get a kick out of seeing the photo. And I later had Shaq sign it for me. So those are a few thoughts on Shaq. The next one I wanted to mention was Allen Iverson. And I actually saw Iverson play, too, in person early in his college career. It was a game at the Capitol Center, you know, before Georgetown moved to the downtown D.C. arena. They were playing out in Landover, Maryland at the Capitol Center, but they played St. John's. And St. John's, at the time, a player named Felipe Lopez was actually probably more highly acclaimed than Iverson, and Lopez had been on the cover of Sports Illustrated just before then, and so got to see Georgetown play and beat St. John's in the Capitol Center, and saw how dynamic of a player, even though very small in stature, how dynamic Iverson was. The other Iverson story is, for years I played a lot of pickup basketball in San Diego with Chris Marlowe, who maybe some listeners just heard him do a lot of the sand volleyball broadcast in the Olympics, and Marlowe's a former San Diego State basketball and volleyball player and was on the USA 84 Olympic volleyball team. So I know once Marlowe went to become the play-by-play announcer for the Nuggets, which he's still doing today, that this was after the first year that he was in the league, he came back in the summer and we got together, played some ball, and I said, so the players you see and have an up-close look at, what player just kind of blows you away? I mean, there's a lot of great players, and obviously having played pickup with Marlowe, we loved the game and talked about players of all eras and all abilities, and the name without missing a beat, he said Allen Iverson, for his size, is the most amazing player I've ever seen. So just having that perspective made me even watch Iverson a little bit more intently and see what he was able to accomplish for someone that size. A couple other quick thoughts. Yao Ming, obviously with him, such an impact on the globalization of the game, and you know, having a player from China of his size and skill set and personality, you know, has really done a lot to help the game explode on a global level. I guess the thing with Yao that surprised me, I just remember watching him early on, how he continued to improve and develop. But then as he kind of got into the midpoint of his career and got heavier, stronger, I just thought the wear and tear on him, I really felt like they should have managed his minutes better to try to extend his career. Because as we've seen with a number of big guys, you know, with foot problems and just a body of that size, the pounding up and down of an NBA season year after year, and then you toss in with Yao, he's playing for the national team for China. I wish they would have managed his minutes more so we could have enjoyed his career a little bit longer. That's my
absolutely
my thought about Yao.
Let me jump in on Yao, because people might not know this, Bulls fans might not know this, but the Bulls actually had, I believe, the number 2 pick in the draft where Yao Ming was taken. They took Jay Williams from Duke, I believe, in that draft. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Tim.
I think that's right.
And I to this day, I remember reading an article about Yao Ming, where originally Yao Ming wanted to go to Chicago. You know, he had a decent-sized Chinese population, and he was interested in going to Chicago. And Jerry Krause sequestered him in the meeting. I think he ordered Chinese food in the hotel. They didn't even go out in the city. Just basically stayed in the hotel. And the gist of the article at the end was, after Jerry left, Jerry Krause left, Yao Ming did not want to go play for Chicago. I still remember reading that article. I can't find it anywhere on the internet. If a listener can find it, please email it to me. But, you know, Krause had been fired immediately after reading that. When you have such a personality disorder and you are so incapable of, you know, ingratiating yourself to a draft pick that you, you know, basically embarrass yourself and you completely do a, you know, 180 on a player like that, where he no longer even wants to go to Chicago. That's a horrible representative for your organization. And I'll never forget reading that. And, you know, from the moment I read that, I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy with Krause up to that point. After reading that, I said, this guy's got to go. And I still stuck around, I think, for another year or two.
Right, right. Well, I don't know that particular story, although I do remember when Yao came to the U.S. for kind of his big showcase workout for all NBA personnel. It was in Chicago. It was at Loyola, at the old Loyola gym. In fact, I've got a photo of it somewhere, and I'll try to post that one as well.
Yeah, maybe that's where they had that meeting. But just the idea that you would have the guy in his hotel, keep him there, order in Chinese food instead of taking him out in the city and actually, you know, experiencing the city and ordering a steak, you know, maybe even enjoying some, you know, American food, exposing him to that. The guy just had no social skills whatsoever, and that goes back to even the glory days, and it just stuck with me. So if anybody finds that article, please forward it on.
Right. Yeah, I'd be interested to hear that as well. Well, a couple more names of the new Hall of Fame class. So Tom Izzo. So most of our listeners should know him, and obviously he's still active coaching in the Big Ten at Michigan State. And I recently was forwarded an article, and some of the listeners might have seen it, that it was a poll of college coaches, and they asked the college coaches that they had a son, what college coach would they want their son to play for? And, you know, and Izzo obviously was right up on the top of that list, among others. And so, you know, and having been to 20 Final Fours, a number of those years, Michigan State and Izzo have been in those Final Fours, but other years, spending time at the coach's hotel and, you know, kind of mingling with different coaches in the game, both past, present, Tom Izzo is always one of the most approachable and genuine people I've ever run across in the coaching fraternity. And so my personal encounters with him have always been positive, and he's in the moment and just, you know, a wonderful guy from that standpoint. Now, when you get him on the sidelines and practice with a whistle or on the sidelines of a game, obviously he's all business and tough love and development of players and just the culture and program that he's built at Michigan State. And you got to keep in mind, he was Judd Heathcote's understudy. So Judd Heathcote was an incredible coach there, won the championship with Magic. So those were some tough shoes to step into with someone like Judd Heathcote. And Izzo has obviously taken it even to another level, right, which I don't think most people thought when Heathcote left that Izzo would take that program to the stratosphere, which he has. So the other thought with Tom Izzo is a few years back they played a college game on a ship here in San Diego. They've done that on occasion, and I was fortunate enough through some of my dad's Navy connections to get a ticket. I took my nephew, who was a corpsman in the Navy, with me, and we really enjoyed that whole experience. But what I'll remember after the game is, you know, obviously we're all on the ship, and so the players and coaches all had to exit like everyone else to go to the team buses, which were parked off the dock. And I just remember Tom Izzo, every person that wanted a moment with him as he was leaving the facility, he would take the time, an autograph, a picture, and not just do it, you know, out of, kind of out of habit. He would really be in the moment, like make eye contact, you know, give everyone their moment with him. And I just always stuck with me to see him really be conscious of doing that. So,
the second that every person I've ever spoken to who's met Tom Izzo has had nothing but great things to say. I personally, every time I've heard him, I've been incredibly impressed with his knowledge. And not only that, he's made an oasis out of Michigan State. Judd Heathcote, you know, obviously had Magic Johnson. They won a title in 1979. But there were a lot of lean years after that, between that year and when Heathcote retired. I don't recall Michigan State. I don't know. I could be wrong on this, but I don't really recall them winning too many Big Ten titles in that interim after Magic left and after he retired. He really brought the program to a whole other level where they're consistently in the Final Four. And this is Michigan State. This isn't the oasis of college basketball, and he's made it that. And I can't say enough good stuff about the guy. I just think he's the best coach in college basketball today, and he will be until he retires.
Yep, I don't think you can find any argument with that from me as well. Well, let's talk about two more before we wrap up. One is kind of an old school player, kind of right in my sweet spot, a guy named Zelmo Beatty, who unfortunately passed away a few years back, but is now getting inducted, and basically played from the early 60s through the mid 70s, originally with the St. Louis Hawks, and then was one of the first players that jumped to the ABA. And then he ended up coming back to the NBA to finish up his career in the mid-70s. But a couple of interesting things about him is he was out of Prairie View A&M, and the St. Louis Hawks had a scout, a guy named Marty Blake, which sometime we should talk about some under the radar and influential people in the game. And Marty was one of the early scouts that really kind of scoured the Tier 2 schools and smaller colleges for players. And so to find somebody out of Prairie View A&M like Zelmo Beatty was a real scouting accomplishment in those days. Even today it would be. But so that's an interesting sidelight to the story. And then when he went to the ABA, he won a championship with the Utah Stars with Bill Sharman as the coach and one of the great ABA teams in Utah. And one thing I read about him, which I thought was one of the funniest things I'd ever read and so accurate. So I remember watching Zelmo Beatty play, and he had a certain posture and the way he carried himself on the floor. So he's kind of an undersized center, probably a 6'9 center. And a basketball writer at the time named Jim O'Brien said he moves about the court like a snobbish butler, which is so accurate. If anyone who had seen him play and the way he just moved around on the floor, it really was the perfect description, as odd as it sounds, of how Zelmo Beatty carried himself on the floor. But snobbish butler or not, he was a winner and had some great seasons, and now is finally getting inducted into the Hall of Fame.
And then, I think Marty Blake, as an aside, Marty Blake, I think, was the actual guy who discovered Scottie Pippen. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Well, it could be. He was a key guy in the Portsmouth Invitational, where you get a lot of those, under the radar college prospects and small college prospects. So I would bet you're right that he probably did have a hand in that and was a key guy behind the scenes in scouting up until he passed away. And I believe his son is still a key guy involved in the combines and scouting for the NBA today. So we'll have to do a little more research on Marty later, but I do remember as the GM of the St. Louis Hawks, he was known for finding players at small colleges or, for African-American colleges, traditionally African-American type schools that maybe were a little off the radar for a lot of the NBA teams who, believe it or not, in those early days were looking through college basketball magazines, the day of the draft to try to figure out who to pick next.
right.
Yeah, well, then the last one went on and is only fitting for the Bullseye podcast is Jerry Reinsdorf. So, and obviously, since this is a kind of a Bulls-centric group that's listening to this, we don't really need to delve into too much about Mr. Reinsdorf and what he's done with the franchise. But, obviously, he hit the jackpot with Jordan and what that meant to the franchise and the city. But, as a franchise over the years and under his leadership, the Bulls have consistently been pretty good and pretty well managed. Obviously there's been some dips just like any cycle of a franchise. But when you look at what that franchise means to the league and the stability and the consistency they've had over many years, it starts at the top, and that's him.
Yeah, it's
I'm sure there's a lot of the fan base who isn't a big fan. You know, I'm kind of torn on him a little bit. I think, you know, he's shown tremendous loyalty to the people he's hired, and you know, that could be a good thing. But, you know, in terms of Krause, he obviously chose Krause over Phil Jackson and MJ, and I think that was a huge, huge mistake. But I do think picking, you know, John Paxson to take over for Krause was the right decision, and I think that a lot of those wounds have been healed, obviously, with Scottie Pippen returning to the organization, and due to the fact that Paxson basically was hired, and Grant, and, you know, other guys that had that were basically, you know, ripped away from the organization due to that siding with Krause. So, you know, overall, six titles after buying a team, and I think for most of the years, the Bulls have been a contender under him, with the exception of those post-Jordan Krause years. You know, I guess it's deserved, the big picture.
Yeah, well, I think you just look at the big picture in terms of consistency, you know, where you have some franchises that have languished or not done well for extended periods of time, and it seems like he's, you know, like you said, kind of made the, when things have gotten off track, he's made some moves to get that corrected, either, like you said, getting an ex-player back into the fold, like a Scottie Pippen, and making sure that he's, you know, a part of the organization and a face of the franchise, as well as trying to do the right things in terms of coaching and front office and player acquisition to make the Bulls competitive and a contender. But well, Fred, great to talk with you. I always enjoy watching the Hall of Fame induction speeches too, to see how these players acknowledge people that were influences to them and their histories and some of the emotion that comes with that and kind of people watching in the crowd as well.
Yeah, Tim, I really enjoyed it as usual. I mean, your knowledge of the game is really unsurpassed out of anyone I've ever met. So I really enjoy always talking with you about basketball. And this was a very enjoyable episode. You're almost giving us an hour of your time. So can't tell you how much we appreciate it. All the best to you, brother. Let's talk again soon because the season's rapidly approaching, not that far away before training camp begins.
Absolutely. All right, Fred. Good to talk with you.
All the best, Tim. Talk to you soon.